described as a book closer in spirit to a performance by the King of Pop himself, something graceful, capable of moves both liquid and percussive. And our moderator, Thelma Golden, director and chief curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem, is, as I said, is our co-sponsor tonight. Thelma came to the Studio Museum from the Whitney, where she curated many notable exhibitions, including Black Male Representations in Masculinity, of Masculinity in Contemporary Art. At the Studio Museum, Thelma oversees one of the city's cultural treasures, a rich exhibition program, an important artist in residence program, education and public programming, school youth, senior, and family outreach programs. And finally, Hollis Robbins, who is Skip's co-editor on this book. Hollis is a member of the humanities faculty of the Peabody Institute of Johns Hopkins University, and she's currently working on a wonderful book-length project entitled Post Office Stories, Communication, Circulation, and the Structure of Narrative Literature. Ladies and gentlemen, our four guests.
Situated.
That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. My God.
Good evening, everyone. This is a great pleasure to be here to have this conversation with these three incredibly exciting individuals. As I told Skip earlier, I came to Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin through James Baldwin, as many people did, but I actually had the privilege of being a student of Baldwin's in the middle 80s in Western Massachusetts at Smith College. And he taught us Uncle Tom's Cabin by way of his essay, Everybody's Protest Novel, and then gave us somewhat of a sermon about why what we should think and feel about Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin itself. So it was a great introduction to me into how I understood what this book really was about and its great impact on Baldwin and then ultimately on all of us. But that really is the second half of the story. And I'm wondering if you, Skip and Hollis, can talk about what brought you to this project of re-examining Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Well, I wanted to... First of all, I was approached by Bob Weil, the editor at Norton, because it never occurred to me to edit this book. And he asked if I was interested in doing it, and I said, and I asked Hollis if she was interested. But the reason I was interested is that I wanted to figure out how a book that was so popular among African Americans, particularly African American intellectuals in the 19th century, Frederick Douglass, William G. Allen in 1853 reviewed it. Frederick Douglass wrote about it between 1853 and 1855. Du Bois in 1903 talked about how beautifully rendered the book had been. And James Weldon Johnson said the two most important influences on the shaping of the African-American literary tradition, The Souls of Black Folk and Uncle Tom's Cabin. And he wasn't being ironic or cynical or talking about it in a negative way. How a book that those gods of the black tradition could revere so thoroughly could become reviled for our generation and the person who was the hero of that novel become the epithet for race betrayal, for the worst thing that you could possibly be in the African-American tradition. So that's why I did. Also, I fell in love with the book because I saw it when I was about 9 years old on Little Rascals.
Do you want to go take a look at that now?
Before? Yeah, sure.
It's the best part.
When Eliza crosses the ice floes, and then when Little Eva dies, these are two of my most vivid memories from my childhood, and it's from the Little Rascals. And then, when was the film, the 1930s?
I think it was 1937, yes.
37.
Up here. Sorry.
We have sound.
Let me go back a little bit because this is so wonderful.
little Eva is about to come back to life.
There we go.
Well, it was a bit more powerful when I was 9 years old.
Can you talk a little bit about what happened between the 19th century and this great popularity?
What happened was the Great Migration. And as we know, starting about 1910 and ending, historians, I think, end the Great Migration about 1970, millions and millions of rural southern black people moved to urban areas, first in the South, and secondly, southern people moved north. And by the first time Stephen Railton at the University of Virginia records the use of the phrase Uncle Tom in the sense that we use it today was 1919 at a Marcus Garvey rally. And Bishop McGuire. And he used it in the way that we would use it. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about that. There was a huge class division within the African-American community. There was always a class division in the African-American community, of course. But when the southern migrants came to these settled northern urban communities, the class tensions implicit in the race just exploded. So there were many essays. Go back and read Du Bois's Philadelphia Negro, which was published in 1899. It's very condescending about people from the South and new arrivants, as Braithwaite would say.
Then expressions start emerging like, you know, clothes that look kind of country. What's she doing in that mammy-made dress?
Yep, you got it.
And it's Aunt Chloe from Uncle Tom. Yeah.
Absolutely. So by the Harlem Renaissance, by the time that Alain Locke published The New Negro in 1925, people were saying the day of Aunt Jane and the mammy or the Uncle Tom is over, there's a new Negro here. So there were all different kinds of new Negroes. But it's the first time within the race that a phrase was used to define who was in, who was out, who was politically correct, as we would say today, and who was politically incorrect. And that fascinates me because I was born in 1950. I came of age in the mid-60s. And we know that Malcolm X famously called Martin Luther King and Uncle Tom, and it wounded Martin Luther King. Malcolm X gave a speech in 1963, and the next night, King gave a speech, and he was in the same city and was pelted with eggs because Malcolm had called him an Uncle Tom and said that he was the 20th century embodiment of this character from Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel.
Which had come by that time to mean not only a toady to the white establishment, but absolutely lacking in any kind of virility.
That's
potency,
right.
Vitality.
Right, and James Baldwin introduced that concept in his essay, which you had to study in your class in Amherst. He said that Uncle Tom was sexless, and that, and literally and figuratively sexless. Mm-hmm. And of course, you don't see him as a virile figure in the novel, but the novel certainly is not sexless at all.
And you say that in your introduction. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Are we going to let Hollis talk?
Yeah, well.
Well, I came to it very late, actually. I didn't read it growing up. It had already not been in part of the school curriculum, so I didn't read it until graduate school. And I thought, my God, this is a book about sex. I wasn't quite sure how it was, but I realized it was all in the discussion of marriages and the various marriages, like Senator Byrd and his wife. He comes home for one evening, and they already have 5 children. One is dead. And he's like, I thought I'd just come home for an evening of warmth. And I thought, oh, okay. And I started looking at the Quaker couples and all the other couples, George and Eliza, very loving, very caring, except the one couple that I thought didn't seem to be loving, though they had a lot of children, or 3 children, was Tom and Chloe. And I wondered what Stowe was doing with that, why she, even within his cabin, was not showing him to be virile. Mm-hmm. And it made me think, well, I think that probably has to do with him spending the entire book with little Eva sitting on his lap, and that just really kind of wouldn't do. So we started talking about that.
Right.
And can you talk a little bit about how you came to thinking about this format of the annotations and the place in which you enter into the text and begin thinking about some of these themes that in this fantastic volume, you know, get illuminated?
Well, Hollis was able to read it in graduate school because of a really strong group of feminist critics, such as Jane Tompkins and Liz Ammons and Ann Douglas, resurrected this book. Mm-hmm. And they read it through a feminist lens. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if what they were able to do for a female readership with this novel, we were able to do for an African-American readership. In other words, to recuperate Uncle Tom as a novel from the this horrible history that all of us associate with the name of the character. And it was Hollis's idea, actually, to try to use, to imitate the way a black audience talks to a movie. You know, for those of you who've never gone to a movie with a black audience, I encourage you to do so.
It's very loud. It's very, 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 very loud.
And it's call and response. And so we decided to do a call and response technique with the, here he comes now, you know. Don't go down those steps. Don't go up those steps.
Well, we decided
to do that.
I was teaching it, writing the bulk of the annotations with Skip while teaching an African-American literature class in Mississippi with a number of very loud black men in the class who had never read the book before, who were not English majors, and would call out all the time. I mean, that book, among other things, and saying, you know, what's going on there? Why is she calling him that? And, you know, so I felt like a lot of my responses, a lot of our annotations were speaking to a person who wasn't a scholar, who was being turned off by the book, was being turned off by the sort of woolly-haired imps language, by the overt sentimentality, who perhaps, well, as you've found, have come to like the book, your students, but need a little hand-holding.
And it's hard going. I mean, there is a lot of woolly-haired N-words in this book.
Yeah, and there's a lot of preaching, mm-hmm. a lot of very sentimental, Victorian, we women are the carriers of the highest feelings, and when I'm at my best, I will bestow these qualities of tenderness and sensitivity onto the Negro, and perhaps that's
right.
His gift. And these things, which leads me actually to my next question. They both sum up and then explode into the culture. Talk a little about this enormous range of illustrations you've got, because it, you know, part of what happens with this book is, you know, it becomes a talking, walking, multimedia phenomenon. You know, it lives in minstrel shows, in cartoons, in dramas, in movies. You know, every actor from, you know, or playwright from Clifford Odets to D.W. Griffith plays in it at some point. I mean, it's amazing. Or a director.
I mean, this book never met a genre that
didn't
like or didn't
like
it.
Yeah, exactly.
It was just extraordinary. In fact, there's a fascinating set of exchanges between Stowe and her publisher about the royalty rate. I mean, as you know, this became the greatest selling novel in the history of the novel, overnight, within a month. And Stowe had been talked into taking a 10% royalty rather than a 20% royalty. And the Jewett was the publisher, and he said, yes, but I'm going to take the other 10% and put it into advertising for musicals and for other forms, and even commissioned John Greenleaf Whittier to write a poem which was set to music about the death of Little Eva. And actually, it's not clear. I mean, it was a publisher's hustle. Bob Weil tried the same thing on me. my agent wouldn't go for that. But they were exceedingly successful in transforming this book into other genres right away. Yeah. By the time she sailed for England, within a year of its publication, it had sold 1.5 million copies. And there were already musical forms and emerging.
Yeah.
And 500,000 women had signed, in the UK, had signed a petition, 500,000 protesting slavery, awaiting, and this petition awaited Harriet Beecher Stowe's arrival in England. I mean, just amazing. We can't imagine how hot this book was and how many forms it took. So we decided that we wanted to include a lot of the visual images.
You want me to look at
yeah,
the
sure. So we did a lot of research. We used the image of the Black and Western Art Project, which is located at Harvard. Karen Dalton, who's unfortunately ill, did a lot of the research for this, and we were able to find. Hollis, why don't you walk them through?
Well, this one is kind of one of the more interesting ones, with because Emmeline, who is a slave. Well, I should stop this one. Stop this one. Well, here's actually a good one to stop with for a while. Eva and Topsy.
This is the one by the French
woman
artist, isn't it?
Louisa Corbeau.
Yeah, and they're among the, they're kind of gorgeous, actually.
They're beautiful.
Yeah.
And this one, she's Emmeline, who ends up on the plantation with Simon Legree at the end, who is light-skinned here, extraordinarily so. I mean, you see the images in a range of color. I guess this is a little bit more solemn than the Little Rascals version. This one again. This one's the Classics comic book version from 1953.
Which is a bit riskier, I believe, than...
Yeah, that's... I love that one. And the same image here, but this one we found actually.
Isn't that great?
It's actually. And it's actually called Condoleezza Rice crossing the ice. And I called him up, Elliot Banfield, to ask, you know, if we could use this for his book. And I think he was a little surprised. Made us pay full price for it. This is one of the darker, not physically, images of Topsy. Usually she gets romanticized in some of the later images. But here is actually a little bit more as Stowe would have, I think, intended. We see a whole range of, this is the, oh, this is Little Eva as Chelsea Clinton. but you see Tom growing and growing young and growing old in various ways in some of these images. Here, he actually looks a little bit virile, but he has gray hair and he's some distance away from Little Eva. Oh, this is kind of out of order. He's dying here. But he's gone back to being very, very manly, as we can see. Mm-hmm. And earlier on, this is the other image. Again, many of these images, the illustrators strive to make sure that when Tom is in proximity with Little Eva, it is not provocative of any way. Here, when he first meets her, let me go back to that. He's virile, but... we don't really know what's going on under the water. But this is characteristic of many of the later 19th century images. This is a cover image where when Eva is, as in the early at Hammett Billings images, close to him, I think the word is dandling on his knee, that he becomes very old and has this sort of fringe of white hair that we saw in the, this one's a little bit dark, but much the same here, the fringe of white hair that became so characteristic that we saw little rascals doing it. And again, how safe is he there?
And the text worries about his safeness. Ophelia asks, I mean, how can you let your child, you know, hang on to this black man? I mean, kiss him, hug him. Mm-hmm. And he responds that, well, he's just like an old dog, so you wouldn't mind your child petting an old dog. But the first time that the sexual, well, implications of their relationship hit me over the head, I was in an antiquarian shop. And it was a postcard, a trade card, from probably the 1940s or 1950s, which I stupidly didn't buy. And it was a virile black man coming out of the ocean, carrying this blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman in a sheer nightgown. And she was dripping wet, and the caption was, Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I went, I have to read that book again.
I just had a couple other ones here. This one I had on while you were talking because it seemed apropos. Because he famously doesn't drink throughout the entire thing. And then this is sort of the most famous image, the postcard that one sees everywhere, titled Uncle Tom, an old-fashioned Southern Negro, who is not at all like what Stowe wanted. Well, actually, I should see this one. This is kind of my favorite one. You can't see it very well, but he's got a really nice gleam in his eye.
Okay, thank you, Alice.
Okay. Margo, I was wondering if you could talk about the fact your work has been so much about dissecting images and what Uncle Tom's Cabin has given us is a catalog of images that have lived on in a way.
And on and on.
And on.
And mutated wildly. Well, you know, Skip and Hollis have presented our Uncle Tom, Uncle Thomas. You have Topsy and Eva are very fascinating to me because Eva really as this little blonde, exquisite Victorian child. You know, I suppose you could say she's connected to Dickens's Little Nell and all of that, but she really becomes a kind of pedophiliac pinup girl. You know, she absolutely becomes, as the shows take her over and, you know, movies and all of that, she becomes this little, you know, adorable, sexualized figure who is simultaneously so innocent. Topsy, of course, becomes, you know, the little pickaninny and the dancing, singing, this natural talent and the reproach of every, you know, young black woman, you know, ever to be raised. But Topsy is the unbounded spirit of black talent, but also the black with no parentage, the wild, dangerous creature. Topsy and Eva show up in all sorts of strange places. They show up in Marlene Dietrich's dressing room in Morocco. They're her little fetish objects. They show up on the keychain of a child molester in a Chester Himes novel. You know, Shirley Temple, to my mind, embodies the fusion uh-huh. of Topsy because she can dance and sing and she's very vivacious and she's got Eva's little curls uh-huh. and you're not supposed to feel sexual towards her, but she quickly becomes the best-selling actress above the Ginger Rogerses, the Dietrichs, uh-huh. the Garbos in Hollywood, and Graham Greene writes a piece pointing out, you know, dear God, how sexy she is. Then she gets mated with Bill Robinson, mm-hmm. Bojangles, who is a kind of Uncle Tom. And it turns out that the man who suggested that they be paired is none other than D.W. Griffith. Mm. Now, so Birth of a Nation has come out. What did Wilson say? History
Writ with lightning, right?
There we go. That's come out 4 years before this wonderful fact you just unearthed.
1915.
That Uncle Tom is used for the first time. So clearly this dynamic, you know, is going on. I think that Griffith is trying to outdo Eliza's by this time, you know, fabulous flight across the ice when he has Lillian Gish floating down the ice floes, you know, in Way Down East. So there are all these subterranean things going on. It's still being turned into plays. And Cassie, you know, is the dazzling mulatto. But I would actually want to ask you two to talk more about sex in this book, because it does seem to me that Cassie, you know, the angry, bitter mulatto, she almost runs away with the book. She has had sex, you know, she is full of rage and anger, she's wildly moody, she's incredibly clever, she's almost a villainess, but she's also a heroine, and she, and in a funny way, Topsy, represent the sort of unbounded female psyche. Topsy is created right after Pearl in The Scarlet Letter. You know, so you know they're the ones who, in some way, represent this undomesticated female anger that Harriet Beecher Stowe, as a middle class, virtuous Christian woman, can't, I think, you know, express fully.
No, I think what you said is absolutely spot on. In fact, we tend to forget that Tom dies protecting two black women.
Thank you.
You know, I mean, how bad is this? Uncle Tom, you will recall, is beaten to death because he won't say where Cassie and Emmeline are, and they're hiding up in the attic.
Let me ask you a question as two scholars, though. Is that because your footnotes also point out all the mixed motives and, you know, emotions and the voice of Stowe, whom you could strangle one moment and then cheer the next. Mm-hmm. Is it entirely the responsibility of the readers that one forgets that with Tom? Or does it also lie in his creation, his representation as a character? You've touched on it with the sexuality that... Mm-hmm. He's muted, but not.
Well, he has to stay a little bit distance from her. Leslie Fiedler talks about how she's very much of a Mary Magdalene figure, this sort of long hair, fallen woman that he saves in a way and brings into the family structure. And I think the way Stowe brings her into the family structure at the end with all the coincidences with everybody being related to one another. So therefore they're safe and their past indiscretions are then forgiven. And I think that's part of the distancing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
That then we see him as acting as not only as a Christ figure, but as somebody you forget the plot that happened up to that point. Mm-hmm. He's dead, everybody else is happy, and so he must have done something. What was it again?
Mm-hmm. Right. Or he must have been too weak to live, even though he's a Christ.
Right.
Figure.
But Cassie uses her charms, as it were, to protect Emily, because he buys this other tragic mulatto to abuse, Simon Legree does.
Yeah.
And Cassie, who's in and out of his bed, goes back into his bed, in effect, in order to protect this 15-year-old. I think she's about 15 years old. And then concocts this brilliant strategy of going up into the attic, pretending that they've escaped to the swamp, but they're really hiding up in the attic. And they manipulate the trope of the mad woman in the attic and invert it by pretending to be ghosts, representing themselves as ghosts, and spooking, as it were, Simon Legree.
Yeah.
So it's a very clever representational strategy going on with Stowe. Be taking conventions and turning them on their head.
Yeah.
But there's no question that Cassie's sexy to me. I mean, she was a voluptuously sexy woman in the text, and I noticed that right away.
But yeah, whereas mulatto, the tragic mulatto tends to be, because she's tragic, because she's genteel. And yet, you know, she's too good for her station, and she's always proving that black women are not low.
But think about her in relationship to Eliza Harris, though. Yeah. Eliza's not.
Eliza has some sex too, doesn't she?
But the sex is represented in the gaze of the slave trader.
That's true.
But Cassie represents her own sexuality.
Exactly.
She's very
That's
much
right.
in control.
That's right.
And she manipulates Legree. She's brilliant, and she ends up escaping by pretending to be a ghost. Quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. But, tragically, those actions lead to the death of our hero, Uncle Tom. Mm-hmm. But it's a good question that you ask. Mm-hmm. I mean, how would you change it? If you were trying to make a hero for the ages, right?
Yeah.
You know, I keep thinking, who is the audience for this book? So we could go to Bishop T.D. Jakes' church, right? And everybody in the church could read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and Uncle Tom would be a hero. I mean, he's the Christ figure. He dies to save these two black women. I mean, it's quite wonderful. But if you try it with a group of hip-hop-oriented adolescents, it's harder to pull that off. It's harder to represent him as a hero, to recuperate him from degradation back into the ranks of the hero.
Us back to some of what you point out, both of you, the link with Baldwin. You talk more than once about the various homoerotic threads also going on, you know, partly set up because he is passive and feminized, or seems passive and is a feminine Christ figure. So could you talk a little more about that?
Good people. Well, he is, I mean, he's, and Leslie Fiedler also calls him a white mother, that he's the best mother. Sweet, mm-hmm. that he's kind, he's feminine, he's soft, he's covered with flowers in the whole second part of the book.
He takes care of everyone.
And he takes care of everybody. And it is, to get back to the Cassie question for a second, it's the one place in the book where you see Stowe's Christianity not being enough for the plot. Because
exactly.
Cassie's supernatural concerns, her, the ghost stories, the... Stowe having Legree think there's something magical about Eva's locks of hair, mm-hmm. that Stowe has to reach for something that's out of the Christian discourse
exactly.
for a minute, and then brings it all back in.
And she's beside herself with happiness
and
for that period.
Again,
of time.
At that moment, you know, when Tom dies, he doesn't die in Cassie's arms. He doesn't die in Emmeline's arms. He doesn't die in Lucy's arms. He dies in George Shelby's arms.
Right.
And you know.
And without Eva's locks of hair.
Exactly. So
right.
What's up with that?
Yeah,
that's
what
students would say.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too dangerous, too potent. That's what's up with that.
Yeah.
So that really brings us to, how do we read this novel now? I mean, you teach this as well, Margo, as Hollis does. So how do you imagine that with all of that, how are we able to read this novel now and understand it within contemporary culture and history?
Oh, doesn't Hollis want to go? it's very difficult because if students are reading, I mean, I think this flawed thing as a novel that Henry James, with his usual suppressed sense of sexuality, called an enormous flying fish of a novel. You know, it's extraordinary. I think it is a kind of national epic. Mm-hmm. You? But, you know, your national epics aren't necessarily your best novels. It came out around the time of Moby Dick, 1 year after, 2 years after The Scarlet Letter. So you have to, I think you partly have to teach it as this cacophonous thing that's busting, breaking all forms, for one thing. You know, it's almost like, you know, an opera, you know, there's all these characters with their different voices. She has a wonderful ear.
Great ear.
Better
than black on the authors of the slave narrative. So if you look at William Wells
true.
Brown's dialect.
I know, it's a little
It's
lame.
Terrible.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
hers
yeah.
is...
It's kind of lame. No, hers is absolutely spot on. No, she's got New Englanders, she's mm-hmm. got, you know,
Kentucky
working
bar.
Class New Englanders mm-hmm. and Southerners. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And she's got this wonderful secular sense. I mean, the book opens with these two men of different classes mm-hmm. smoking, talking about money, property, and it's a, you know, it's this kind of seductive scene.
Mm. But she's a snob.
She is of course. What middle-class white woman, what middle-class woman of the 19th century is not going to be a snob?
That's
she's
true.
Absolutely a snob, and she's, you're right, she's too easily snobbish about the slave trader. But mm-hmm. the problem with this book is it's so easy to feel superior to it mm-hmm. because she exposes her flaws at every moment, mm-hmm. You know, because she is inside it. She's a participant. She doesn't have that full novelistic, you know, I'm a master. I don't even know that she wanted to. But that really is the problem. How do you get them to acknowledge that everything this woman is talking about, you know, from struggling with what we think of as racial traits, even mm-hmm. though we claim now that race doesn't exist, you know, to these strange marital triangles, you know, the father, the slaveholder, Eva's father, who is clearly in love with his daughter, and not with his wife, you know? And,
sure.
you know, how do you get them to see all of this complicated you know, human, the American family, the, you know, the black family, the white family, this geographical sweep from north to south, and not let them feel superior. That's the problem.
Or angry because of the contextual racism.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not any time a black character comes into the novel, you know that they're black because they're called woolly head or black skinned or
yes, ebony, hued. Yeah,
and it's not a very polite thing.
For all of our snobbery, she had bad manners.
Yeah, bad manners. But if you could, if we could persuade a generation of black students to read it as an allegory of a different time in our people's history, time of deferred gratification, time of
very much so.
Time of self-sacrifice. Yeah. You know, a time when, by deferred gratification, I didn't mean it in that way.
I wasn't thinking that way.
I meant it in that, you know, we, our people had a future. And no matter how bad, you know, we were the Israelites, you know, we were the children of God. We were coming out of Egypt. And no matter how bad it looked, there was a better day coming. Yeah. And we just had to believe. And you had to make this crazy sacrifice in order for us to happen 150 years later. And also, just everybody in the world wanted to read this book.
Which is so interesting.
Everybody in the world wanted to read about this black man who was willing to sacrifice himself, you know, for this larger ideal of Christianity.
Yeah, it's true. Who was better than any other person in the world. You know, I mean, he really was an absolutely superior, morally human being.
Right.
Oh. Yeah, no, it's also, I mean, it's another chapter in America's obsession with the figures of black people, you know, and that's interesting, too. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the first potent chapters.
The opening chapter.
It's the opening chapter. That's right.
But it's very much, too, about the escape of black women. I mean, Eliza escapes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Cassie and Emmeline escape. Well, George escapes.
George escapes.
But Uncle Tom doesn't. I mean, unlike all of the narrators of the slave narratives.
This
right,
is very true.
That he is the one who stays back on the plantation. He's the one who picks the extra cotton for the slaves who are weak.
Absolutely.
And he's the one who's terminated at the end for his principles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very a contra narrative, a contra slave narrative in that way.
Well, we used to get into, we had some very nice arguments about it. At what point in time would Tom raise his fist?
Yeah, right. If little Eva, if Simon Legree had attacked little Eva,
he might have.
I think that Tom would have lost his Christian principles and defended. Do you think that's reasonable?
Yes, but I can't imagine the circumstances under which Simon Legree,
right,
unless he was molesting her, would have attacked her.
Yeah, but that's the only
way
I can think of Tom actually fighting back, which drove Malcolm X crazy.
Yeah.
It did. When you read Malcolm X's speech about Martin Luther King, it just is this figure, the idea that you wouldn't fight back, it just is, it's unmanly to him. And in a different way than Baldwin. Baldwin talks about sexlessness. Mm-hmm. Malcolm talks about masculinity, about turning the other cheek. But he's anti-Christian anyway.
He is. And also, you know, also this is a woman's novel. Harriet Beecher Stowe is trumpeting in her, you know, in her own way, you know, the purity, the power of female religious self and female secular implicitly self-sacrifice, moral virtue. You know, it really is a struggle between the so-called male soul and female soul, that novel, don't you think?
Yeah, but that's what drove Baldwin crazy.
Yes, indeed.
Because Tom becomes a feminine soul
by not
being masculine, quote unquote,
except
he is masculine. He dies to protect these two women.
It's true.
So it's an ironic form of feminization, if indeed it is feminization. I interrupt you.
No, there was just, it's been, the book has, is getting a sort of new life in, by, there's a fellow named Wellington Boone, who is on the Promise Keepers circuit, and he talks about this book as an excellent example of masculinity. And he says, this is exhibit one of black masculinity. The name of his book is Your Wife Is Not Your Mama.
Oh, God.
And, you know, I looked in the index of the book to make sure.
This is its latest incarnation in mass culture. Okay.
And it says, you know, if being a man means laying down your life to protect your women, I'm an Uncle Tom. If being a man means, you know, selling yourself down into slavery to protect your family, I'll Be an Uncle Tom. Mm. He takes a long list of it. And apparently, I don't know how it's selling, the book, but.
Boy, if we could get on the Promise Keeper circuit, Bob, that'd be a heavy thing.
What was your most interesting discovery in the research for this book? I mean, you all have sort of really copious, fantastic notes, and there's so much you seem to unearth around the varying reactions and analysis. What was, for both of you or either of you separately?
Do you want to start?
Well, actually, the funniest thing is something I ought to have known anyway, which I learned actually in reading Joan Hendrick's excellent biography of Stowe, is that Stowe, in July, I think, of 1851, when she had started the book, wrote to Frederick Douglass to say something like, you know, can you help me out here with a little research?
She wanted Douglass to describe what a real plantation looked like. Harriet Beecher Stowe spent 17 days in Kentucky on a slave plantation. That was it. And so she wrote to him saying, I'm writing this thing in the National Era. I need a little research.
And there's, as I think Robert Septo said, there's no record of that he wrote back. Yeah. That was my favorite.
Well, I think that, you know, the Stowe's book was so popular, it upset so many people who were pro-slavery, that all these people accused her of making it up, and particularly exaggerating the horrors of slavery. Mm-hmm. So she immediately produced a book that was called The Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is full of all these documents, very difficult book to read. And she said that she had based Uncle Tom, the characterization of Uncle Tom, on a black man who had written a slave narrative, mm-hmm. Josiah Henson. Mm-hmm. And Josiah Henson was a real person, and he escaped from slavery in 1849, I believe, and he escaped with his family. Mm-hmm. But there's no evidence, I mean, if you read Josiah Henson's book and you read Uncle Tom's Cabin, there's no evidence to me that that she is modeling Uncle Tom after Josiah Henson. So she's being very opportunistic. She had to cover herself in some sort of way. So there's Josiah Henson. So what's Josiah Henson do? He publishes a new edition of the book, The Real Uncle Tom, and rewrites his life to conform to the portrait of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, I think only in America, as Don King would say, could this possibly happen.
Also, the other funny thing was in terms of the cultural afterlife, the book, the famous children's book, Black Beauty, was subtitled in its early editions, The Uncle Tom's Cabin of the Horse.
That's funny. I didn't know that Douglass, I knew about from Bob Steptoe's book that she had asked Douglass to do a little research for her. But I didn't know that Douglass had praised the book over and over again in his newspaper, Frederick Douglass's newspaper. And he talked about how authentic its representation of slavery was. And much later, 100 years later, black people would say, well, it's not authentic, or there were no black people really were like this. But black people at the time thought that her portrayal of black slaves, and these are jealous, angry, you know, mean to each other, sadistic black relations represented in that book.
Not only.
But plenty. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Showing the way that slavery debases. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know if contemporary black people would find that.
Yes.
You know, because you don't find that in the slave narratives.
No.
You don't find it in the slave narratives.
That's right. You do find it in Harriet Jacobs, bless her heart. Well, yeah,
Harriet Jacobs makes herself noble by showing the ignobility of the field hands.
Yes.
Right. She says, we were always very special.
That's true.
My grandfather.
Spiteful, jealous.
Yeah, right.
House people. But yeah.
Yeah, her grandfather was a carpenter. You know, we had a house. I could hide in the attic for 7 years. And when you think about it, James Weldon Johnson was absolutely right. I mean, in Harriet Jacobs' 1861 slave narrative, that hiding in the attic comes right out of, it's a revision of Cassie and Emmeline. Mm-hmm. Hiding in the garret. They even use the same word, the garret.
It's true. Mm-hmm. Though this is interesting also, Harriet Jacobs wrote Harriet Beecher Stowe asking, you know, could you write an introduction? Could you help me with my book? I'm working on it. And Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote back, well, maybe I can use some of your life in my next book.
Yeah,
and
that's
right. And Jacobs was
furious. No way.
Yeah. Exactly. And then, though still angling, asked if maybe Harriet Beecher Stowe would let her
young daughter who was going to school in New England go abroad with her. Mm-hmm. And Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote back, well, I think that might get her, make her a little too proud, mm-hmm. you know, being admired by so much in Europe. So, you know, then this probably drove Harriet Jacobs to, in Crazy. Fact, go on and finish
her book.
Yeah,
that
thank
book.
God.
Of course.
Yeah, but yeah, Douglas, too, Douglas had an interesting exchange with Harriet Beecher Stowe. Douglas, ever the capitalist, Douglas wanted a cut of the royalties to build a vocational school for African Americans, and she promised that she would do this. And then she withdrew her pledge that she would fund his school. But Frederick Douglass, for those of you who haven't read it for a while, it ends with this long letter from George Harris to you, dear reader, about the wonders of colonization, about how the freed slaves should go back to Liberia or go to Haiti and form their own nation and then advocate for their enslaved brother and brothers and sisters still in the South. And it really irritated Frederick Douglass. Mm-hmm. And that's the only part that he didn't like about the book. Mm-hmm. He said, dear madam, we were born here and we are going to remain here. Mm-hmm. But Stowe thought that the solution, like Abraham Lincoln did, remember, that the solution to the Negro problem, of the problem of slavery, was colonization, meaning you ship all these people back to Africa or you ship them to Latin America, you get them out of the country. I mean, it wasn't... We shall overcome miscegenation heaven that Harriet Beecher Stowe was advocating.
Right, right. Not at all. I would love to open this to our audience, if you all are open to that at this point. And there are two microphones on either side of the room. We are recording, and I am going to ask that all of you who are asking questions, that you actually ask a question and that you speak into the microphones. There's a question in the back. We can start on either side. I guess the microphone holders, you guys are going to have to decide, because I
wonder if we could turn this thing.
Do you want to push it back?
Moved side? Over?
Yeah.
No,
ooh,
if we could turn it up.
Up?
Oh.
I think that's more comfortable. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
All right.
Thank you.
Ooh. That's not too hot.
No, I need it.
I was wondering if that was the answers.
No.
You said that your first introduction to Uncle Tom's Cabin was through The Little Rascals. Mm-hmm. And for me, oddly enough, it was The King and I, where they actually do a staging of it.
Yes. Right.
And then uses this whole launching point to convince the king that slavery is wrong and all these things. Did that resonate at all with you? Do you have any comments on that movie and how it was used in that story context?
Yeah, that's not how I first encountered the story, but I thought it was very powerful. I mean, I'm not sure what you're asking.
Just as part of the resonance of the story through other forms of literature, mm-hmm. how effective that was.
The story within the story. I thought it was very effective.
And the use of it for that message.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it is the first version of it I ever saw. And
really?
I was enraptured by that movie. And I think, you know, it's a beautifully done and staged movie. But it seems to me that it also hooked up in the 50s with this ability to slightly, for black people could slightly aestheticize and fetishize their suffering through certain Asian theatrical representations. I'm thinking of this and The King and I. I'm thinking of Sayonara mm-hmm. with Marlon Brando. I'm thinking, you know, a little later of Flower Drum Song, you know, but you know, there are a number of movies where there was, you know, the Asian white cross, you know, mm-hmm. and it there was always a, you know, all the black people I knew, there was a kind of, this is respectful and it's subtextually erotic, and it was very aesthetic, so you could have that distance, and that seems to me an absolutely exquisite example.
But you're saying that white people...
I'm talking about black
people. That black people, but we weren't in control of those movies.
No, but I mean as audience members.
Oh, I see.
We often, I didn't mean we fetishized and aestheticized as makers. I think it was a very useful way for us to, yeah. But, you know, you could think that, you know, the movie makers were all, you know, they were mm-hmm. dealing with, you know, that it had to do with Orientalism, imperialism, but, you know, maybe those did stand in the 50s as tropes, larger tropes for racism.
But there's also something very interesting about that characterization in the musical, at least, that it's a harem that's putting it on, you know?
Yes.
And I have not quite figured out what to do with that. Why, you know, it's a group of people that is not part of the, you know, Christian heterosexual marriage thing that are finding something in that.
But Anna is a kind of Harriet Beecher Stowe figure.
Oh,
also.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. And a Mrs. Byrd from the novel.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. And it's a dark complected, bald headed king.
Yes,
it was
is.
Very phallic, though.
Yo.
That's another question. We'll go to that side.
You spoke about the desexualization of the Uncle Tom character, but I also was wondering about Topsy. And how it seemed that in the life after the novel and some of the minstrel shows, she became this kind of genderless creature.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the Little Rascals, the Farina character and the Buckwheat character, which was kind of like a Topsy character, except it was played by a boy.
Right.
So I was just curious.
Oh,
if
Buckwheat
you had...
is definitely neo-Topsy to me. I mean, like from his hair. I mean, when I think of Topsy, I think of Buckwheat and.
Why the gender confusion
the gender
in the
bending.
Depiction of the black child?
I don't know. Why do you think?
She's pre-adolescent. She really is a child, and nothing about her is ladylike, girlish,
boyish
in
yeah.
any way. Mm-hmm. You know, she really is kind of terrifying that way. She has no physical charms. She is wildly uncivilized. She says anything. You know, I never was born, no mother, no father.
She'll steal, she'll lie.
Yeah, so I think in that way, she's set up to break across that.
But she ends up a lady in New England.
She does, alas, yes.
You know, I mean, she... I thought you were asking about Buckwheat.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you know, why would Buckwheat not be a girl in The Little Rascals, sort of? I mean, how many girls were there in Little Rascals? Was it Marla? Darla. Darla. Darla was the only one.
Yeah,
right?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Well, in that Little Rascals one, they saw that Topsy, I mean, that the same little kid had to play both Uncle Tom and Topsy because his little sister wasn't showing up.
Yeah, I had to do that in my school, too.
Just for the record, originally, the performance history is that Topsy, you know, Little Eva was always played by an exquisite young child in the mm-hmm. theater company, you know, or an older pretty woman. But in the early days, Topsy was always played by a grown white woman who was considered the broad comic in the company. You know, so it became the way to act out and be naughty and wild and nasty, and then it crosses gender.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about wanting to introduce this novel to a contemporary African-American audience.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last 5 years, a couple of prominent African-American writers have introduced the novel. Charles Johnson introduced an edition in 2002. Christopher Paul Curtis, the Newbery Award-winning author, introduced one.
Daryl Pinkney.
I was wondering how you saw your edition in relation to those editions and what you're trying to do differently.
Well, they did do an annotated edition. That was the principal difference. We wanted to create a parallel text, really, between the visual history of the book, with the critical reception to the book, and then through our annotations, talk about how black people had changed their minds about this book, and to do it with a lot more patience and detail than the people that you named could possibly do it, just given the limitations of their form. But I think Daryl Pinkney's and Charles Johnson. I don't want to be misquoted. I think all those guys did a great job introducing Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Maybe if we can.
I'm a high school English teacher, and you were talking about, I'm very interested to hear you talk about the troubles that you have teaching Uncle Tom's Cabin. Certainly the 19th century American novel that deals with race that does frequently get taught at the high school level is Huckleberry Finn. And I wondered if, I mean, a huge amount's been written on that, but I wonder if you could just comment on how you would maybe teach those two books together, or whether you think that one would take the place of the other. I mean, they speak so much to similar themes and yet are such wildly different novels.
Hmm. Margaret?
I would not replace one with the other. I think teaching them together would be wildly interesting, in fact. Both Right. You know, ostensibly it would be the sentimentality of Stowe, you know, and the comedy, you know, but with that backbone of seriousness of Twain. But actually, it would break down differently. Stowe can be extremely funny, always when she's creating, you know, kind of mean male characters, mm-hmm. or ones who are, you know, sort of she was an admirer of Byron, who had that kind of, like, Augustine, you know, Byronic mm-hmm. note. So, and Twain, I don't think I can pull this off, meaning you can't call comedy that becomes too cheap, which parts of that book do. You can't call that a form of sentimentality, though I wish I could pull off that comparison. But, mm-hmm. you know, he does maybe a certain kind of comedy that doesn't do. It's too, you know, it's too easy. It's too sitcom-y. That deserves as much hard, cold thought as we have been giving sentimentality and
you
the sentimental tradition.
Between Huck and Jim?
I mean more when Tom Sawyer comes back into the novel. And, you know, even the those long passages between the Duke and the whatever. You know, when Twain does his often brilliant comic set pieces and it gets thrown off, that would be very interesting to look at. Reader response. You know, I think the whole Huckleberry Finn dispute has gotten pretty coarse. But the fact is, there are moments when, I think as a black reader, you find it excruciating, as with Uncle Tom. And then, boom, you know, you're somewhere else moments later. And really tracking that. By the way, they became friends in later life, Stowe and Twain. As she confessed, she had an unsanctified liking for slang. And they would write these, you know, snappy letters, and they mm-hmm. were neighbors, that's right. So, you know, you've just gotten me thinking about it, but I think it would be amazing to pair them because it would say so much also about the male and female literary traditions.
And I spend so much time defending Huckleberry Finn that I wouldn't ever, ever throw it out of the canon, because there's so many parent groups, particularly black parent groups, that want to throw it out of the high school curriculum because the word nigger appears. And that kind of...
Then they sure don't want Uncle Tom's Cabin.
And then Uncle Tom's Cabin. I know, but what we have to do is help people to understand that just because the word nigger appears doesn't mean we have to throw the book out.
Yes.
I mean, we can use these as teaching opportunities. And we can make 1,001 justifications, but for goodness sake, we can't lend ourselves to censorship.
No, it's not leaving the way Paul Mooney thinks it's going to. No.
I was just wondering how relevant you might think it that Harriet Beecher Stowe had other interests and other accomplishments, let's say, beyond Uncle Tom. I know we're talking about Uncle Tom, but to me, she was one of the great resources when I was writing about the 1848 revolution mm-hmm. in Paris. I mean, she wrote one of the richest and most seemingly objective descriptions of what happened when the Louvre was under fire from the revolutionaries. In other words, she had a pretty sophisticated political understanding of what was going on in revolutionary situations, abroad. You know, she was a very astute critic and viewer of things apart from, say, her writing of Uncle Tom. And I think in some way it's relevant to our understanding of the book to know that she had all these other interesting aspects, too.
I think you're right that she, there are many comparisons in the text to the Hungarian Revolution of 1848. And she said, when she's talking about George Harris, who is the mulatto who escapes and who fights. I mean, he shoots the white men trying to capture him back into slavery. And she said, if he were a Hungarian revolutionary, we would be creating statues to this guy instead of thinking of him as some crazy black man who's breaking the law by running away with his own property. Stowe was part of, one of the best things that happened to Harriet Beecher Stowe was Cincinnati. And she was part of something called the Semicolon Club. And it was, it seems to be, at least from Hedrick's biography, the very open between the genders. I don't know if that's not a very elegant sentence, but men and women met regularly and exchanged writing and read and critiqued each other. And I think that a lot of her, the cosmopolitanism, some friend of mine might say, that you're describing in Stowe's writing comes from that time in Cincinnati. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I think we tried very hard to bring some of that revolutionary discussions into the annotations, where she talked about labor, where she talks about the various things going on in Europe. But I think it's also fair to say that we wouldn't be talking about her were it not for this book. I mean, she was very interesting, wrote a lot of very interesting later books, some a little less uninteresting than others, or more uninteresting than others. But, I mean, that this is the thing she is known for, and for that reason, probably the best repository for every other bits of research that we can do to, or that somebody wants to do to have it hover around this text.
That, you know, I would certainly teach The Pearl of Oars Island. It's, you know, it's a really fine regional novel. I would probably teach Pink and White Tyranny, where she, in a sense, is, well, it's one of the first vicious, well, admirably vicious critiques of a certain kind of female consumerism, and it prefigures Edith Wharton and someone like, you know, a character like Undine Sprague, for example. So, you know, she's an interesting figure.
I think her awareness of class relations in the United States, it just is astonishing.
Absolutely.
To me. I mean, it's like Marxian, if you, as it were, when she's describing middle class life in America, as well as the relationship between slave owners and non-slave owners. Surprisingly, keen observations about economic relations in the United States.
Yes, exactly. Yes, any novel that begins with a factual discussion of money is to be trusted. Which is a line.
Is to be trusted or not to be trusted?
Is something honest is being told you.
Okay, I just want to say I enjoy the discussion and it has encouraged me to write a poem, so probably by the end I'll write a poem. But I just, Mr. Gates, I hear that you said that how Malcolm always referred to Martin as a Uncle Tom. Who would you consider to be a modern day Uncle Tom? And if we're teaching this book to students, who would we relate it to? Who would we have them relate it to? Because for me, when I thought about it, I thought about just the movie. I thought about like The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. There was a little white girl and they had a black man, and I kind of related that movie to Uncle Tom, just in the sense that how he was protective over her. So who would you consider, is there anybody that you would think that you would have the students relate to? I mean, in a sense that you would say, you know, I know some may say Colin Powell, some may even say the mayor of Jersey, but.
No, the mayor of Newark? Cory Booker? No. But you see, I thought you were asking, remember, I'm trying to interpret Uncle Tom as a black man who dies for these two black women, right? Not like Clarence Thomas. Well, so I'm caught because I want to critique this terrible moment in our history when we read each other out of the race. But you know, I can't. Every time there's a Supreme Court decision about affirmative action, it drives me crazy. The black man is, you know, voting against affirmative action, so I'm a hypocrite, and I understand that. That's a problem for me as a professor. You know, I have to defend the right for my students, black or whatever, to come out of whatever ideological bag they want to come out of. And if anyone would call my Uncle Tom my class, I would, you know, crush them like a bug. I'd do the best that I could. And I theoretically defend the right of Clarence Thomas to be Clarence Thomas. But with my other black self, it's very hard for me. But I can't think of that. I would not call anyone an Uncle Tom. I wouldn't do that. I've been called Uncle Tom. There's a book, you know, Uncle Tom's Among Us. Cornell's in it. I'm in it. You know, I don't know who else is in it. I only looked up my own name in the index. And then I looked up Cornell for company. And that made me feel a lot better. I did buy the book. But it would be interesting for me, and I'd have to think about it, and I'd love your opinion. But
what would you?
Yeah, okay.
If there were a redemptive possibility to that.
Right, who would be the self-sacrificing, I would say that in my lifetime, and again, I'm 56 years old, Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, Malcolm was absolutely right and wrong at the same time. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King gave his life to free black men and black women. I mean, he is the closest figure I could think of to Uncle Tom as depicted in this novel. And I don't want the King family coming. Don't misquote me. Gates calls Martin Luther King, Uncle Tom.
Let us quickly mention Gandhi.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Just like Mahatma Gandhi.
There we go.
Right?
Throw,
just
it
like
in. Throw it
thank
in.
You. Thank
that's
you.
It. Woo.
I want to get invited to the memorial opening, you know.
There's been some conversation this evening about our early encounters with the novel, right? So in 1976, James Baldwin talks about his first encounter with UTC. He's 7 or 8 years old. He's reading the book obsessively, fanatically. It disturbs his mother from the South, now in Harlem. She keeps hiding the book. She finally hides it at the highest shelf above the bathtub. He climbs up there and gets it. She stops hiding the book. In 1948, James Baldwin published Everybody's Protest Novel. He asks the question when he talks about the kind of trap of categorization, the fictive quality of race, yet its historical persistence. He says, for those of us who are trafficking what he calls the kind of medieval morality, the virtuous, the self-righteous, and hard-boiled sentimentality of Stowe, why are we so loath to go beyond that liberal figure? And so I ask you guys, as you reconsider Stowe this evening, why, as we deal with a persistent contemporary fact of race, and we know that it's fiction, why are we returning, as Baldwin asked in that same essay, why are we so loath as a nation to go beyond the kind of what he calls laudable efforts of Stowe, but still ensnarled, entangled with the fiction of American race?
Well, your question was almost the pastiche of James Baldwin. I mean, you were very Baldwinian in the way I'm not trying to flatter you. Just I love Baldwin. I used to imitate him all the time when I was a kid or a teenager, and that's what the structure of your sentences was very Baldwinian. I had absolutely no idea what you just said, however. So I didn't follow your question.
He asked, why are we so loath to go beyond Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin? We're reconsidering him the novel this evening. The persistent fact of race that Malcolm X, MLK, Emmett Till confronts in American society, the kind of the quest for national innocence, mm-hmm. the way he's talking about.
But I think he's wrong. I think that we've gone far beyond Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Okay.
In terms of our, first thing, we have so many black voices that have emerged representing race themselves since 1851, you know, when it was first serialized, right? And we have Baldwin himself representing race in every possible combination and venue that he could think of, apparently. I just don't think that it's true. I think that we haven't solved the race problem. If that's what you're asking, I think the reason we haven't solved the race problem is that it's a problem of race and class. But I don't think it was ever just a race problem. I think it was about economic relationships. And I think that the society, through affirmative action, decided to adjust enough so that some of us could become members of the middle class, and then that door slammed shut, and we still have this vast underclass. And until we have a more direct economic analysis of the problem, I don't think that we're going to solve the race problem, if ever we're going to solve the race problem, because you can't solve a problem that wasn't really a problem in the first place. It was a race and class problem, or it was primarily a class problem manifesting itself as race. It's not as if race didn't exist, but it was about economic relationships. It was always about economic relationships, and everything else came after that. That's what I believe.
Are you also asking why there would be a need to go back to this text again as an emblem of certain crises, problems we haven't?
There was a direct engagement.
engagement with the essay by Baldwin in 48 and...
you mean a direct engagement in the introduction? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So what I'm saying is there's a part of the essay that says, we find ourselves bound first without, then within, by the nature of our categorization.
Yes.
That society is held together by our need, by legend, myth, and coercion, right? Mm-hmm. And so the legend, the myth, the fiction of race and class and all gender and all that kind of stuff persist. And so what Baldwin was asking in 1948, I'm asking his question. It's not really that complex. It's a simple question. Why are we so loath to go beyond what's being proposed by Stowe? That liberal fiction, what people say about Melville and Twain in the 19th century.
I'm not sure who we is, but you know, as a society, yeah, we are still. But I think looking at those fictions with all of the experience and knowledge that we have acquired and are acquiring, does make a difference. When we were reading that book before, we could never have said in the same way that you just said it, race is a fiction. Mm. We know that it is now in certain ways. And I think, you know, taking our own history, every part of it, and by our, I mean American, in with all of that new knowledge makes a difference. I think it's very dangerous to... You know, nations have psyches too, and just the way in people do. And you cannot simply close down your past. You cannot block out parts of your psyche and believe that you are simply going on. You have to find some way to rename it, reshape it, transform it. That's how you get through it, I think. Not, you know, and then maybe past it. But we're not anywhere near.
But Stowe,
yet.
Stowe certainly didn't believe that race was a fiction.
No,
not at all.
No, we know that in certain ways, literally, scientifically, it's a fiction. It is still not a fiction functionally at all. Neither is gender, neither are economics.
Well, just because it's socially constructed doesn't mean it's
exactly.
not real.
Exactly.
in some sense.
So.
Right. But we moved a long way from believing that, I mean, no one respectable can represent race in the way that Harriet Beecher Stowe did as a real thing that exists in these sort of blocks and categories that are perpetuated biologically and be taken seriously. That's a hell of a transformation over the last century and a half, and a very important one. And I think that James Baldwin played an important role in the critique of race as a thing.
I think we have time for one more question, though I know we could continue this conversation for a long time. And there it is.
This panel is just so amazing, and I think with... looking on the website, the New York Public Library website, and just Googling you guys, it's led to, you know, me wanting to read a lot of other books, too. My question is, do you feel that the negative stereotype associated with this book has overshadowed the historical impact of the book? And also, what reasons do you think the book has sold so many copies, second to the Bible?
Well, I think that certainly since the 1920s, since the Harlem Renaissance, black people stopped reading this book. And black people read it like everybody else up until the 1920s. And that's what fascinates me most of all. And that's it's very, very important. And after 1948, 1949, when James Baldwin wrote about it, everybody stopped reading. Lots of people stopped reading the book after that. What was the other part of your question?
Take away from its historical points.
Well, what do you think?
Well, it's impossible to be neutral about the book. I mean, it's really impossible to be neutral. I mean, on the question of race, she clearly believed that all races would be equal in heaven, but not here. And that's a difficulty. And I think I think that your question is a good one in terms of why Baldwin kept returning it. I mean, if part of your question and your question is why do we return to it when there is so much racism in it, we return to it because it had an impact, because it had a huge impact. And we've gotten beyond the impact of it, and perhaps but it's not just a historical artifact. There's something more to it. And, you know, writers from Tolstoy to Henry James to Baldwin have been struggling with what that impact is. And I certainly, after spending three intimate years with this book don't know what its mystery is, where it lies.
But it is something of a mystery. We return to it because it is, you know, it is absolutely jammed to overflowing with everything from the most primitive impulses, you know, to describe, to categorize, you know, subconscious eruptions, canny, you know, intuitions and insights into the world. So we return to it, I think, because it's this kind of map, you know, of a somewhat unbounded artist, preacher, you know, person with all these limitations and gifts, and, you know, you can't not find something of your worst self in it, as well as, you know, bits of, in fact, at moments, your best self. But when we return to it, because we're never above it. We're never completely beyond it.
And if you're writing a history of African-American literature, if you're teaching African-American literature, if you're studying African-American literature, it is impossible to understand the development of the narrative tradition in the 19th century, particularly, without reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, because black people spent their time rewriting this book over and over and over again in both the slave narratives and in other novels. Even James Baldwin, which is the point of my essay, that Baldwin was obsessed. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, his mother hid it, he found it, he wrote out the sentences, he wrote out the paragraphs, he rewrote them, and then went long and internalized those sentences, I think, and heard various aspects of her novelistic technique played themselves out in his own novels. So that I think that Uncle Tom's Cabin is just, other than the Bible, the most important silent second text in the history of African-American letters, without a doubt.
And American letters, it is. Again, I'll go back to, I do think it's a national epic in American literature.
I want to thank Hollis Robbins, Henry Louis Gates, Margaret Jefferson, and I would also like to thank my colleagues at the New York Public Library for having this wonderful conversation, and I'd like to invite you all out into the lobby area where Professors Robbins and Gates will be signing copies of the book.
I think we should thank Thelma Golden.
Thank you.